and simulcast with wolfspiritradio.com. Join JP, your tour guide today, on this journey of discovery from the known to the unknown in search of enlightenment, knowledge, and truth. Good evening, good afternoon, and good morning to you all here from Revolution Radio Studio B, and indeed from Wolf Spirit Radio and Ever Beyond Radio, if you could actually get there. But, you know, I've been under attack. Hey, people, somebody has started to find a dislike to what I've been saying, which is kind of usual. I've been waiting for it to happen. I'm kind of used to this. Anyway, so this is JP on Journeys with JP, and tonight my guest, he may be able to help me. Oh dear, it's been a heck of a week for everybody, and it's a kind of global thing. And even before Friday evening, when, you know, in Britain it happened at midnight, and in the Paris debacle or whatever happened at midnight, so it's not, almost not really Friday the 13th anymore. But there has been a rising sense of unease in the last few days, weeks build up. People have become more and more itchy and scratchy, and rather difficult to calm down. What's that word? Fractious. Fractious, that's the word. Maybe we can find some answers tonight, I hope. Because, I really wanted to kind of take away from the whole, big panic of the moment, and work things back into ourselves, because it's always, always, always about how we deal with and respond to the times in which we are afloat, like a boat. It's like being on a high sea. So, to that end, I would like to welcome author of Conscious Being, Awakening to Your True Nature, TJ Woodward. Would I say Mr. TJ? Or TJ, good afternoon, TJ. How are you?
TJ, thank you, JP. Thanks so much. I'm delighted to be on your show.
Well, it's good to have you here. So, this is Journeys. We talk about the journey, and it's the journey from the everyday world to the inner world, really, and being able to see that the inner world is quite a lot more magical than the outer world, and it's bigger on the inside. Infinite on the inside is how I call it, like the TARDIS. So, we've been talking, a couple of hours ago. We just had a little chat, and we talked about some of the things that we like to talk about here. One of the things we started at, a lot of people have heard my theory on the nature of addiction, which is the yeast consciousness, which I have given the delightful little name of NUNG to, NUNG. And my listeners have heard me rant on about the NUNG and what it does and all of that stuff. My concept is that it is, in fact, it's a parasitic consciousness that feeds on us. There's the what they call the clinical consciousness that says that addiction is a result of a brain chemical imbalance, esotericists may say that addiction is the result of too much X-ray in the astral body, or something. Where do you start? Where would you like to start on this?
Well, thank you. I think, I do work in the field of addiction recovery. I'm very blessed to work for Foundations Recovery Network at Foundation San Francisco IOP. And one of the reasons that I am so grateful to be at Foundations is we really look at addiction from a holistic perspective. And what I mean by holistic is looking at the whole picture or the whole person, not fragmenting it into this or that. So recognizing that addiction has a physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual component, the role I have at Foundations is the spiritual care counselor. So I get to view addiction through the spiritual lens and recognize that on some level, there is a spiritual aspect to addiction. There's a spiritual aspect to recovery. So that's where I would begin to discuss this, is to recognize or to let you know that's kind of the perspective that I come through. Okay. And the lens at which I view addiction through.
Okay, in that case, what would you say the role of karma has in the experience of addictions?
Well, thank you. Karma, you know, when we talk about karma, depending on how we define karma, it could mean a lot of different things. For me, karma, I recognize karma to not be an outside force. I think a lot of times we talk about karma as something happening to us, like in the classic sense of the word, karma is I do something and the universe responds in kind. To me, karma is much more of an internal experience. In other words, it's a held perspective. It could be a collection of thoughts or stories or beliefs I have about the world, and I go about believing that or experiencing myself as that, and then the world seems to respond in that way. So it's a collection of thoughts that I continue to have, a collection of stories I have, and then the world seems to be pushing something back to me, but in fact, it's actually happening from the inside out. So from that lens, I think karma has a great impact on addiction. So I know we could talk more about that, but I wanted to first talk about like my sort of perspective on karma.
Yeah, so the concept is that we're a single being experiencing it ourselves. And other people are different lenses of the same being looking out from different, you know, source points, but still the same thing. So, I mean, when you talk about addictions, do you also include the concepts of things like obsessions? You know, like when you get somebody who just won't let you go, you know, there is a karmic component to that, isn't there? There's like something has to play out. And
yes.
How does that work out? I mean, how's that mechanism work for you?
Yeah, well, again, through the lens of looking at karma through the lens of it being an inner experience rather than an outer experience, karma would play a great role. And of course, you know, simply defined, we can define addiction in so many different ways, but one of the, you know, primary characteristics of addiction is looking for something outside of ourselves to, you know, solve or to fix an inner malady or an inner issue. So certainly obsession with another person could be an aspect of addiction, or we could certainly be addicted to other people or having that kind of obsession for another person. Again, maybe there's an external karma, but more than likely it's something happening within us. So we're seeking something outside of ourselves to really correct something that feels out of balance internally. So in that way, certainly relationships can be an aspect of addiction.
Interesting. So intriguing. So in terms of how you get to the treatment of it, what approach do you take? How did this thing start, or when was the last time do you go kind of backwards in time, or do you take a completely different take a more creative approach to getting to the heart of the matter?
Yeah, thank you. One of the things I'm so grateful for working in Foundations is that we have a team of people that really assist with the different aspects of addiction. So I don't need to necessarily concern myself as much with the physical aspect of addiction because someone else is working with that. not that, that we're, you know, a person is a fragmented self, but the lens through which I assist someone or treat someone with addiction is this spiritual and emotional lens. So for me, it's about helping people. It's really creating a space for someone to explore within themselves some of those core beliefs that they've picked up along the way. So many times people in an addiction and the work I've done, I recognize that so many people are carrying around some core misperceptions or false beliefs about themselves. Really, those core false beliefs, something like, I am broken or there's something wrong with me. And from that, of course, they're looking for something outside of themselves to help them find some relief from that. So the treatment that I work with and the assistance I offer with people is really creating a space for us to explore, to go back and look not so much about what's happening with the addiction, but what really preceded that, what is happening in those core false beliefs and those worldviews that have created a perspective or a way of being in the world where we're seeking something outside of ourselves. So I really assist people in looking within and reframing living our lives from the inside out rather than the outside in.
Excellent. And so when you take these approaches, when you make these approaches and you find that this thing hides that thing, are they unique or do they kind of fall into groupings?
You know, it really is remarkable to me in that all the years I've been working with people in addiction and really people in general, because we can absolutely say that on some level, all of us might have some addiction to something outside of ourselves. So I can say that there's a full spectrum of what we might call addiction. Classically, of course, we think of addiction as drugs or alcohol, but there are so many different things that each of us could be addicted to. In working with people, it does seem to come down to a few of these core beliefs. There's something wrong with me. I can't do it. I'm broken in some way. You know, really working with someone that is having a deep experience of shame, you know, the difference between guilt and shame is guilt is I've done something wrong. Shame is I am wrong or there's something wrong with me. It seems that in the work that I've done with people in an addiction or coming out of an addiction, there seems to be that core false belief, that theme that there's something wrong with me, that there's something wrong with me and the world, really a life based in a very shame-driven perspective. So in that way, I find that there's a similarity in that experience, that at the core of it, there's a shame-based way of being.
And that's a very interesting thing, because if you look at civilization as it is, it kind of relies on it. It relies on shame. It relies on shame for people to be civilized, more or less.
Yeah, and you know, it also, you know, almost so many of the things that in our capitalist society, so many things that they're trying to sell us is really speaking to that shame. I guess you could say like a really good marketing might speak to that. Buy my product and don't feel like you're broken. Buy my product and you'll be fixed or you'll be whole and perfect. So the idea, it's revolutionary to say that we're whole and perfect essentially, and then we have this idea or these beliefs that we've put on top of that essential nature that create a distorted or a false sense of self. And it's not about finding something outside of ourselves to feel whole and complete. It's about recognizing that we are that essentially. And that's why the subtitle of my book is Awakening to Your True Nature, because this is about unlearning those things about ourselves that we have been carrying around that prevent us from experiencing our wholeness and perfection in the first place.
Exactly. Now, this is part of my quest, my journey, because, you know, speaking to these people all over all these years is like, you know, everybody's got a piece of the puzzle, of the grand puzzle. So I'm learning about that. But everybody's got a piece of my puzzle, and I've got a piece of their puzzle. In the exchange that happens, we exchange pieces and we give out pieces, and it's great. It's a win-win-win thing.
Yeah.
So looking, so all of these things is, you know, it's their journey, it's my journey, it's my journey of becoming the person that I am from the person that I was conditioned to be, if you like. If you don't like conditioned, you could say traumatized into, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, it really is. I had a 30 years ago now, nearly, I had a bike crash and I suffered from PTSD. What the heck? Why is my hand doing this? I was coming out in welts and, you know, it looked like stigmata, but it was because I'd experienced so much pain that my body just says, I'm going to give you some more itchy. Take that pain and give you and add you some itchy. And I couldn't understand what was going on. So, and, you know, I had various other little weirdo things until I discovered what PTSD was. And I was like, you know, it underwent a physical shock. And so it got me interested in the idea of what shock does to people. And now I am watching it unfold on Facebook, on you know, in the chat rooms that I look at. Everybody's experiencing shock. That's what these false flags are doing. So, having said all that, there are ways of dealing with that. What the kind of treatments, and is it possible to scale it up to worldwide, because everybody's been traumatized? How do we decondition our world and recondition a new one?
Yeah, and that's the big question that we're all seeking right now an answer to, right? Those of us who are on this spiritual path.
That's right.
Thank you for framing this as trauma, because that is absolutely right. You know, Don Miguel Ruiz in his book, The Four Agreements, calls it the domestication of the human. And I actually really love that, because if we operate under the knowing that we do come in essentially whole and perfect or connected with our spiritual essence, some people don't really like the term whole and perfect when referring to someone coming into this world. What I mean by that is really that we come in with an absolute connection with ourselves as spiritual beings, and it seems that we are then domesticated or traumatized into the ways of the world. So in that way, it is the work of spiritual awakening is very similar to the work that we would do in healing what we call trauma. You know, trauma, of course, depending on which circle you're discussing it, is going to have a lot of different meanings and certainly a lot of different solutions. What is at the essential truth of working with trauma in all its forms really is about presence. It really is about creating a space where we can feel safe enough to recognize our essential self and dismantle and question and look at all of those other things that we have put on top of that, or have been put on top of us, essentially, like what you said with domestication, you know, or trauma that has been given to us. You know, we think we're doing something to serve our children by, quote, teaching them the ways of the world, but in a way, what we're doing is we're actually, you know, traumatizing them away from their spiritual essence. So for many of us, our spiritual journey is about dismantling and unlearning and returning to that essential truth that we are.
So this is the return leg of the hero's journey, because we leave, we separate, we initiate, and we return. Let me address. I'm looking at the chat room here. We have a question from Bunny Love, who's saying, who is a life coach herself. Very interesting. Is there another person working directly with the addiction while you're addressing the core beliefs, or is it something that is approached later in the process? Yeah. Are you like a, I mean, for want of a better word, like a production line, or is it kind of simultaneous experience?
Yeah, it's happening simultaneously, recognizing that there are different aspects, or, you know, seeming aspects of what we call being human, right? That we all have a physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual aspect. We're not actually, you know, of course, a box with four sides. We're actually an integrated whole human. And at any given moment, different aspects may need to be treated. So certainly, We're working all simultaneously with our client to assist them in whatever is emerging in that moment. You know, it's certainly in the work with trauma and addiction, we don't want to go in there and try to force anything, but we create a space for someone that when they are ready to address these different aspects, we are there for them. So it is a team approach, of course, but it's certainly not, you know, step one, two, three, and four that we go through these different levels. It can happen simultaneously, and it can also be a process for people. For many people, and I think the question at the root of the question seems that for many people, they need to work with the physical aspect, the mental aspect of the addiction primary, so that we can get them to a place where they're stabilized enough where we can do some of this deeper work with the emotional and spiritual healing. And that's generally the case, but not always. Sometimes people come in, they put down their addiction, and they recognize that what was driving that addiction is this spiritual malady or unresolved trauma or an existential question in their life where they are feeling separate from themselves in the world, and that the spiritual approach is absolutely needed or wanted for them in the initial stages. So it's not a one-size-fits-all. We really meet people where they're at. I meet people where they're at. I work in partnership with therapists and psychiatrists so that people can really get holistic care, meaning that we do treat all aspects of them simultaneously.
So a holographic approach, really?
Yeah, you could say that for sure.
Sorry, I didn't give you enough time to take that drink. excuse me. How very interesting. So, let me just reroute where we were going with that. We're talking about the transformation of the human from that which is covered over. I mean, it's amazing because tonight I was talking with Rebecca Jernigan earlier on our new TV show, and we were talking about what her guides call the construct, which is a kind of mental overlay of belief systems that are harmful to us, you know. First of all, How do you approach dealing with belief systems that are patently untrue? If somebody believes something that would you like to talk about what core belief really means? I mean, say nobody knew about, because it's a particular kind of jargon to say the word core belief. Can you explain how the core belief is formed and what that process is? Because yeah, I think absolutely. That's a really very important, I want to see it from the inside out, if possible.
Yes, absolutely. And I guess I can answer this kind of in two different ways. One is, you know, we're all carrying around beliefs that may or may not be true to any kind of degree, depending on which lens we look at it through. I mean, we, in a sense, our beliefs and perspectives about the world affect how we experience the world. So we could say that every belief or every perspective is correct and also limited, you know, rather than saying one is correct and one is incorrect. We're carrying around a set of ideas or beliefs or ways of being in the world that on some level are both true and also limited based on our ability to, or our consciousness, our ability to see. When we talk about core false beliefs, and I appreciate that you recognize that it's a particular jargon, and at the root of that, we're all carrying around some core ideas about ourselves in the world, whether that's something that was taught to us. A lot of times in work with people in the addiction field, there is a traumatic experience. You know, there's a legitimate traumatic experience. And what I mean by legitimate is one that impacts a person's soul or psyche, not to compare externally what is trauma, you know, because I think sometimes we hear people minimizing their trauma because they say, well, that person over there had something much worse. And so we're certainly not saying that. But these core false beliefs, the way that we can assist someone in getting to those is to provide a space where someone can begin to share their experience of the world, to really re-experiencing some of what has happened to them, whether we call that classic trauma or we call it life. And to be able to recognize that through that or from that, they've created a worldview or a world perspective. And so, again, this is about helping people to unlearn that which is not useful, or to recognize that people are, there's a longing for something deeper or a more expanded level of consciousness. Wherever people are coming at this, each of us has a set of beliefs that we're walking around with, and without questioning them, nothing changes, right? So, we can talk more, a little bit more about the how to if you're interested in that.
I certainly am, because, you know, we have lots of people out here who are, you know, perhaps it may turn somebody to say, oh, it's not that hard. You know, because part of the thing, it's so hard. I've been working on myself for 30 years and I'm still messed up. You know, and you think, well, why should I bother? Look at the state of that person. They've been working on themselves and they're still completely messed up. But there are ways in which we can turn ourselves, and in the end, we can only turn ourselves. Nobody can turn us for us, can we? It's got to be our free will, because in a way, the whole trauma is that our free will was violated and we have not been able to redress it.
Yes, to integrate that, absolutely, and that's one of the greatest paradoxes, right? We have to do this each individually alone, and yet we don't have to do it alone, right? And that's the value of community in all its different forms. That's the value of a good therapist or a good counselor or a space that we can go and absolutely be our authentic self and explore what it means to unlearn. In some way, of course, this is a process. You know, I mean, another way to say that is we're always evolving, and yet we have these quantum moments where we have an experience where we are choosing. You know, I mean, in my own story, I was walking around in the world having no idea that my, you know, what we call core false beliefs or my perspective of the world, or even you could even call it opinions, are creating how I experience life. And without questioning and expanding my viewpoint, nothing is going to change. So in that way, if I still believe I'm a victim to the world, nothing's going to change, because it's all very temporal or very temporary in the outer realm. So, you know, whatever process we use to get down to changing from the inside out, and that may look different for each of us.
So in terms of a how-to, how would, you know, well, I mean, if I were to walk in, which presumably I wouldn't, but if I were to walk in the front door, you know, like, there I am, a mistake, I've been, you know, I'm 12 pounds, it's like, I'm skinny, I'm not looking very well, and I come in. Presumably I have to have enough money to deal with all this, but how would I approach having, you know, been traumatized, gone through addictions, and, you know, at some point you bang yourself on the head and like, what the heck am I doing? I've got to sort myself out. So somebody comes to your door, or is that where the stage would be, or would it be a lot further back than that, you know?
Well, I mean, you know, personally, I personally work with people at all different levels and, you know, all different life situations. So, you know, one group of people I work with certainly is people that are coming out of an active addiction. And again, you know, that, It's not one size fits all. So one person's going to walk through the door and need to be stabilized, you know, emotionally, mentally, and physically before we start to get to some of these deeper spiritual questions, which is where I come in. Or someone might be absolutely ready. So I think stabilizing in some way, you know, if someone's been active in an addiction for many, many years, there's going to be a lot of physical ramifications and mental too that need to be addressed, probably or possibly before that person is going to get down to some of these deeper questions. I mean, someone who's been active in addiction for 20 years, it probably wouldn't be useful for me to come in on day one and say, let's explore your core false beliefs. You know, they're going through physical detox. So, you know, we have to treat people where they're at. Where I work, with people is when they get to that moment where they recognize their way of doing or their way of being is no longer working. And I think that can come with someone in an addiction, or that can come with someone that recognizes they want some deeper meaning in their life. And for many of us, and I'll include myself in this, it's pain that can often be the motivating factor in that. You know, it becomes too painful to continue to do life the way I've always done it. And so people come and then they're ready for this deeper exploration of what needs to change from the inside out. So the how-to, when we get to that point, one of the greatest tools I know to use is questioning. You know, I call it living in the question. It's certainly not a new idea, but When we get to the point we recognize that our perspectives, opinions, and worldviews are affecting how we experience life, then we recognize that nothing changes if nothing changes. So we can question our thoughts, question our ideas, question our beliefs, and see what happens as we dismantle some of those structures of knowing.
And, because, you know, I've been wondering about this. I'm going back to a trauma, but say a very young child gets falls over, you know, in the street, actually gets a concussion, and somehow is kind of knocked out of themselves a little bit. What moves in? Where does it come from? Where does this new personality come from? The one that is the post erasure personality. How does that happen?
Well, my short answer is I don't know. You know, and I think that's one of the things, you know, to recognize that there is a physical aspect and a mental aspect as well. So, you know, with someone in that situation, there's probably neurological issues that need to be addressed. So, we wouldn't get to these, you know, sort of deeper philosophical or spiritual questions until that person is stabilized physically. So, you know, the short answer to that is I don't know. That would be kind of out of my scope or out of my realm of working with someone. They would need, you know, probably neurological testing and help in that area first before we got to some of these deeper questions.
All right. Yeah. I get the scope thing. My question is, it's about the, we're a fragment of a light being that is inhabiting this skin suit, this vehicle.
Right.
And it's having a human experience. Like we take our RV out to the country to have a country experience and have a country drive and experiencing the country roads. And we got these dashboards and temperature sensors and engine speed monitors and things like that. So we have an interaction. When something like these dysfunctions happen, we lose the ability to read these dials. Does my analogy make sense?
Absolutely.
What happens? I mean, what would be an analogy to what happens, and how do we reconnect those disconnections?
Well, I think each person in their experience is unique. I mean, when I work with people that are having, like, let's say it's a person that, you know, has gone through their life and had some, you know, sense of material success, or they've had a relationship that's really fulfilling, and maybe they have an experience where that changes, right? So, like, maybe it's a divorce, maybe it's, you know, the children leave home and there's that longing for something deeper. I think that, you know, working with people in order to help them recognize that we are indeed, as you're saying, all aspects of the one presence or the one power, you know, all different aspects of this light being. And this, then it becomes about how we return to that. How do we experience ourselves in that way? And in so many ways and in so many experiences, people at some point through life experience, many of us come to that place where we question and we wonder, you know, those deeper questions of what is the meaning of life? What is this deeper calling for a deeper sense of connection? And then we can begin to explore how we do move into a deeper experience of ourselves as spiritual beings.
And indeed, that's what it's all about. That's, you know, this is, from what I can see, is we need to clear the way for the driver of this vehicle to be able to drive the vehicle properly, you know, and you know, clear the toys away.
Absolutely.
A mountain of toys under the feet, under the pedals and everything, you know, and you can't go anywhere.
Different people have a different, you know, way of reaching that point, right? So for many of us, it's like the toys we've been playing with quit working in some way. So then we're left with, you know, is this all there is? Or there's got to be some deeper purpose to life. You know, maybe I've achieved my material success and I still have that now what moment, or is this all there is? Or what is my purpose here? And so then we begin to join in others on this return to source, this return to our essential nature. And that comes, each person has a different, maybe pivotal moment in their life that question begins to get asked.
The denouement. And, you know, you're usually at the end of some road, again, back to the car analogy, but it kind of works. Is that, you know, you've taken a direction in life that really you see in the long term is kind of unsustainable and, you know, juvenile, or you know, just not particularly correct. And again, there's at that point there's the tension between the will to keep on doing what you're doing just for the bloody mindedness of it, or the pain of not changing.
Absolutely. And that really is it, right? When the pain of remaining the same becomes greater than the pain of change, we're ready for change. And that seems to be the human experience, right? That at some point, either an event happens where we question the way we've been living, or when it just becomes too painful to see ourselves down a road that isn't serving our highest and best, or we're not getting what we want, or what we're getting what we want, and it's not bringing a sense of fulfillment that we hoped it would. You know, so many people, you know, might come to me or come to any counselor or therapist saying, I want to find the perfect job or the perfect partner, or, you know, find my purpose. And when we're talking about that in the outer realm, you know, we can use all different tools to manifest that. But I think the deeper question is, what are we seeking in that? In other words, if I think I'm going to get the perfect partner and then I'm going to be happy, we recognize that that's actually in reverse, that's actually backwards. So we begin to explore, what is it I think that partner, that job, or that, you know, that finding my purpose is going to bring us? And then we can start working from the inside out and recognize that maybe we already are that essentially. And that changes the equation dramatically.
Yeah, and this comes right back to these core beliefs of the, if you believe you're broken, that will hold that form of being broken. But we are not broken.
Correct.
Everything else around us is telling us that we're broken.
Yeah.
For their benefit. Because if we're broken, then we can't, we don't have the confidence in ourselves to be manifest, to manifest the things that we wish to do, to, you know, to fulfill the soul purpose.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's what are the things that get in the way? Those what you call negative patterns, you know, whatever you might call them, forms, that get in the way of these things. And like you were saying before, there are only a very few of them, aren't there?
There really are. It does seem to go into a few categories, but I think essentially, you know, at the core of this, these false beliefs really is a sense of brokenness, a sense of being fragmented. So in a way, you know, you can say the spiritual journey, as we've already said, is that return to wholeness, that return to our essential nature, that return to recognizing that we're all one, and that that is the great journey, returning to this. So all these beliefs and these strategies and these opinions that we've had as a way to cope with our life need to be questioned in order for us to even begin the journey to integrating back to a whole person.
So, the whole person. Whole people are not needy. Whole people are not lacking in, well, let's phrase it positively. Whole people express themselves without limit. Whole people are effective in their expression. Whole people are grounded. Are all those true?
Absolutely. And for most of us, it seems to be a process. So wouldn't it be great if we could reach, well, I don't know if it'd be great. let me rephrase this. My ego mind told me that it would be great if I could reach a place of absolute wholeness and be finished with this process of evolution. In my experience and the people that I know, it is an evolutionary process where we're continuing to evolve into more and more wholeness. So in one moment, I may recognize that all those qualities you just expressed are the truth of who I am. And then in another moment, I may forget that. And that's maybe the reason that we're in relationship. I think you're speaking to something really powerful. Like, let's talk about it through the lens of primary intimate relationships. If I believe I'm broken, if one believes they're broken, they're going to be looking for a partner to complete them. And, you know, we hear this all the time. And yet, you know, one of the things that we hear all the time is, you know, why do I keep attracting unavailable people? And my question is always, what are we wanting them to be available for? If I'm looking for anything outside of myself to bring a sense of wholeness or being complete, it's not going to work because it's always temporary. It's built on a very shaky foundation. So one who does their inner work, when we do our inner work and recognize that we are essentially whole and perfect, then what we're doing, what we're looking for in a relationship is quite different. We're actually looking to share that with another person, very different than looking for someone to fix some problem that we believe. You know, in other words, when we're looking for a relationship to fix this belief that we're broken, that is never going to happen in any permanent way. And that's where we see relationships having this experience in the beginning. You know, we call it the honeymoon period, where this person does seem to complete us. And then we reach this place where it's like, wait a minute, this isn't working in the way that I had hoped. That's because we're looking for someone outside of us to do our inner evolution and our inner transformation.
So what ends up is that we end up sharing our feelings with each other. Either we say, I'm feeling this, or we make them feel that way. That's the way I've always found it, is that they, you know, if somebody has been maltreated, they will maltreat me. And that's how, you know, that's how we experience other people. And
right. Hurt people, hurt people.
Hurt people, absolutely. That's right. And that's how we perpetuate, that's the word, and propagate this stuff goes all the way down through history. And you can, you know, because people will say, well, it was my dad, or it was my mum, and then it'll just go back, and it'll go back, and it'll go back, and it'll go back, and it'll never stop. Somewhere along the line, somebody a long, long time ago was bad, and it just rippled all the way through forward through time.
Yes, and that's why we know when we talk about consciousness and we talk about conscious evolution, we recognize that a shift in ourselves, as Lao Tzu said, the greatest gift I can offer the world is that of my own transformation, right? So when I am willing to be with all that's dark and negative within myself and eradicate that, that's what actually saves the planet, right? Many of us believe that this is something that happens from the outside in. We need to save the world in some way, but really what each of us are called to do is to be accountable for our own awakening so that we can change this pattern in consciousness that, as you said, keeps perpetuating itself. And the same is true in the other direction, right? So the more I'm willing to be love, the more I'm willing to do my own inner work so that I can be present and be love in the world, that also has a ripple effect. And that's how consciousness changes the world.
And we look at the world through the lens of the inner being. And feelings are a problem for a lot of people.
They certainly are.
You know, we look out and then we feel stuff and then stuff happens. And it's most of the time out of people's control what stuff happens after the feeling happens. Because most people are not aware of triggers and of acting out and all those other little jargony words that we use as well. So do you want to talk a little bit about the mechanisms of these things? You know, these like this is like the push pull. You know, this goes this low, if you can, if that's the way you see things, or maybe you use different images.
Well, I think part of what you're speaking to, or at least what I'm hearing, is, you know, this idea that, I think the first thing, like we talk about some of the jargon, as you said, like trigger is a great example. We talk about triggers, and what we usually mean by that is someone said something or did something and that triggered something in me. But what's happening there is I'm not being accountable for my inner experience. It's actually not at all what happened outside of me. It's the agreement that I have made internally. So I use the term activation rather than trigger, because trigger implies something outside of me. In other words, something you say or do or some life situation triggers an emotional experience internally. What's really happening is that I'm activated from the inside. And the difference, although it may sound like semantics or it may sound subtle, it's actually revolutionary, because I begin to be accountable for my own experience. In other words, I'm not blaming someone else or some situation outside of myself for what I call reality. I'm beginning to be accountable. That's a huge step for people to say, what is this activating in me? What am I making this mean? And how can I go about questioning that and looking at that and recognizing that that is actually where a change in consciousness can begin?
And usually it's, if you could express it, is I'm feeling this incredibly uncomfortable feeling that makes me want to run away. I don't know what it is, but I feel it.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's something that is shifting a lot right now in consciousness. People are recognizing, we're all recognizing that there is something about the emotional state that is so powerful. And as you say, so beautifully said, we generally have a fight or flight response to something that feels that intense. That is actually, to me, the root of addiction, is that this is far too painful for me to experience. So let me change that externally in some way, either that through a relationship, through drugs, through alcohol, through sex, through shopping. Let me try to do something so I don't feel this. So we're recognizing now that actually leaning into the emotion, being with the emotion, is actually a way for us to transcend. You know, that's where we say the only way out is through. You know, we at some point have to recognize that a fight or flight response will continue to perpetuate the same dynamic that happens in the world over and over and over again. You know, from the micro and to the macro, where we're talking, that's what really is at the root of war, right? This is far too painful, and let me retaliate. So learning to be with these emotions that we call intense emotions, we might call them negative emotions. I call them more of the term uncomfortable emotions, learning to lean into that and be with that actually is, in its simplest form, the solution for everything that we've been talking about for the, you know, the last hour. The solution for addiction is learning how to be with myself and this intense emotion right now, not making it about someone else, not blaming an external reality or an external situation for this, being accountable that this is happening within me. And if the problem's not outside of me, neither is the solution. And as I learn to be with this, that's what changes the dynamic. That's what changes consciousness. And that's what ultimately changes what we call reality in the world.
Well, not bad. Thank you very much, TJ Woodward. And tonight, that's the end of the show. We'll just have to fill in. I'll play my guitar or something, you know. We'll just do this.
Thank you.
Nailed it in 50, my man. Anyway. But yeah, that's what it is. It's, and I think actually we did exactly what we'd say. We have approached addiction from the other end.
Yes.
From the inside and now looking out. So now we can look at, okay, so there is a feeling that I'm feeling that is uncomfortable that I want to run away from, and I'm going to run in any direction whatsoever, whichever one feels right at the moment. It doesn't matter, just as long as it's away.
Yes.
And so we're then invited to come and sit with this feeling.
Yeah. And that's really, to me, that's the essence of meditation. And like any other practice, that can get interpreted in a lot of different ways. When I first came into a meditation practice, I came into a teaching that was saying meditation was about quieting the mind. To me, that is another form of, we could say, addiction, you know, the addiction to eradicating thought. And what I recognize now, meditation is actually an invitation for me to learn to be with myself, whatever shows up. It's an invitation for me to be able to lean into these thoughts and feelings rather than trying to eradicate them. It's a much gentler approach to myself and to the world. It's learning to be with whatever's present. And when I can do that internally, I can actually do that externally, right? So we could say this is the way to world peace, right? It has to begin within me. Peace is not the absence of violence, because the absence of violence is simply the absence of violence. Peace is actually a way of being, a way of relating myself and to the world where I actually can let things be the way they are. And so meditation for me, you know, some moments, and of course, you know, pleasant and unpleasant is another way to talk about feelings. We all, I would assume, we all like the experience when we go into a meditation and we experience bliss and oneness, connection, much more than those moments we go into meditation and experience our darkness or experience our own ego or experiencing our mind relentlessly running a story. But that can be equally as useful as the bliss experience, because I get to recognize that I can be with that and allow myself to witness those thoughts rather than believing that I am those thoughts. And I'd love to explore that more as the evening goes on.
Sure, because it's instead of saying, you know, my head is this one lump, you know, that it's like, yeah, it's more like a kind of auditorium. With some people at the front and some, you know, there's some projections and, yeah, maybe there's a bar over there. Actually, I think I'm probably over by the bar. Anyway, so drinking water, of course, or tea. I don't drink alcohol at all. It doesn't agree with me. I drink tea all the time. So I could say that's my addiction. But anyway, meanwhile, so we find ourselves holding, sometimes I like to think of it as like, you know, what do you call them? A push pin? We call them in Britain a drawing pin, which is a thumbtack. That's it, sorry, a thumbtack. And if, you know, imagine having one of those on a chair and you're just sat down on it and it's like a very posh event, and you can't kind of reach down and grab it. So you do your best to kind of just kind of move your buttocks and position yourself so you're not pressing down on this pin. And we kind of freeze like that. And, you know, if that pin is representing the uncomfortable feeling, this is where I'm going with this. And we often even distort our bodies because of this uncomfortable feeling. Do you have you worked with people who have had that feeling so extreme? And what kind of trauma makes that happen?
Yeah, and that you know, for all of us, that really is the experience, right? I think, you know, for we may spend many years believing that the intention or the goal is to be rid of that uncomfortable feeling or to adjust ourselves in just a certain way so we don't feel that. And what we find is that paradoxically, when we come to a place in our life where we're willing to lean into that, and that sounds, you know, quite insane to someone on one level of consciousness. So what you're saying is feel the pain of that push pin. And I'm saying, yes, it is, because that's the great angst, the spiritual angst that humanity is often in. You know, let me not feel this. Let me not experience this. Let me find something outside of myself to relieve this. And we're actually talking about something quite different.
Okay, well, we'll talk about that on the other side of this very hard break. Thank you very much, TJ Woodward. Don't go away, everybody. We'll be back.
The opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. This is Journeys with JP on Revolution Radio, a 100% listener-supported station. If you would like, we have various specials on offer, and if you can go to the support page and check it out. We've also, Nighthawk has assembled a very large amount of debunking info and background information all about Paris, if you want to learn about Paris and all that stuff, and why it might be a bad idea to change your Facebook thing. Anyway, my guest tonight for the last hour, we've nailed it. You know, we can just go home now, you know, just play some music. We've been nailing the root cause of addiction in the spiritual, emotional, and physical dimensions, and looking at it the other way. And it's basically, you know, sitting on a pin and avoiding the pin, running away from the pin that you're sitting on, is essentially the same thing, same drive as that drives addictions. Have I kind of nailed that there? Is that, well, I probably pinned it there. We could pin it there.
You pinned it perfectly.
So, yeah, I mean, it is, yeah. I mean, it pins us down. You know, we feel pinned down by addictions. It's, there is very much, you know, the pain of being pierced. And it seems to be in our nature to get pierced. Isn't it? Especially, I mean, you look at babies these days, they get pierced an awful lot. Now, I was very careful not to have my babies pierced with anything. But that's what happens, isn't it? Little nicks have taken off us.
Yeah, and it's you know, that's one of life's great questions, you know, why we come here, why we incarnate in this way, and why our planet is filled with all these opportunities for separation and return to oneness. It seems that's the journey for so many of us, is you know, a sense of coming in whole and perfect and then becoming a fragmented self, and then later in our life, finding ways and tools to, you know, reintegrate and return to oneness. And why we're doing this, I think we possibly will never know, but it does seem to be our path for whatever reason.
So it's like, you know, when you're in the army, as you do, you learn how to dismantle a rifle and to reassemble a rifle. How to break it down and then rebuild it. Break it down, rebuild it. And in fact, that's their way in, you know, military training, is essentially, oh, we break down the man and we rebuild him. You know, that's they even say that out loud. And you know, from what you were just saying, that, you know, here we are. We allow ourselves to be broken down so that we can learn to rebuild ourselves.
Yeah, or
that's a funny old life purpose, isn't it?
Yeah, and it can even be viewed in the reverse, that, you know, we come in kind of broken down to our essential nature, and then people build all kinds of things on top of us, and then we dismantle them so that we can return to a place of being surrendered, if you will, or recognizing our essential nature.
So, yeah, do you want to address, because this is the great fear that people have, and I don't know if you noticed in the break, there's this great line, you know, fear does not exist. Exists only in the mind of the fearful. But anyway, the idea that our fears are often the thing that we're most fearful for or fearful about usually either never happens or isn't half as bad as you imagine it to be.
Indeed.
Or isn't one-tenth as bad as you imagine it to be. I'm going to the dentist, it's going to be really painful, because the last time I remember it. Well, you go to the dentist and it is like 10 times more painful than it was the last time. Sorry, that was a really bad example anyway, dentists really are traumatic for me, particularly. So would you like to address that? And I'll go off and corpse myself.
Well, if I had the answer to that, I would be a very wealthy man. Like, what causes fear and what is the solution to fear? But we do recognize most of us at some point in our life that it's fear that drives so much of the distortion of our life, right? It causes separation. It causes conflict, you know, and it is something that lives in our head. In the mental health field, you know, we look, and now we can talk a little bit more about this, you know, treating symptoms versus getting down to the root cause. And addiction is certainly that way. We often treat symptoms of addiction. The addiction could be called a symptom itself rather than getting down to the root cause. The same thing could be true about anxiety. You know, anxiety gets treated, it gets medicated so that we can numb out the anxiety. But the anxiety is really telling us something. There's something about that fear or that intense anxiety that is a doorway to some sort of knowing or some sort of information. Fear is a strategy, really, more than it is actually a feeling. It's anxiety is a strategy, and we're going to come right back to the conversation we had before the break, which is ultimately the spiritual journey is about learning to be with this moment in all its forms, right? And that, of course, this moment is never as fearful as the thought of fear, right? So fear is always based in, you know, some idea of the future and this present moment. Even, you know, I'll say it this way, and this is an extreme analogy, but even when there's a gun pointed at our head, we're not actually afraid of this moment. We're afraid that that trigger is going to get pulled. You know, so the moment itself, although it can be very terrifying, we're actually afraid of something that's going to happen in the moment. And that's obviously a very extreme example, but it can serve as a metaphor for how we are living in our life, not right here in this very
absolutely
moment.
Absolutely. You're not dead. You're not dead until right. Somebody pulls the trigger.
Indeed.
So that's there can be a long distance between those two states of being as well. And, absolutely. You know, presumably we have a choice to be something in that moment. I would like, we have a call in, and I'm just going to bring her into the call. This is actually the lady who asked the question in the first place, the first question along, Michelle Caruso. Good afternoon, Michelle. How are you?
Hi, JP. Hi, TJ.
Hello, Michelle.
Thanks for bringing me in.
Would you like to go ahead?
Well, I'll just start. I missed 10 minutes before the show up until 5 minutes ago, so I had a little gap of what I missed. But I'm really appreciating your insight, TJ, and it's very refreshing to me. It's in my work as a coach and healer, this is what I focus with people, and it's just such powerful. It's such a powerful way to bring about to me real transformation back to our authentic self. And so it's always, I always get that kind of like, woohoo, there's, you know, it's being talked about and it's being expressed. And I just think you articulate everything very well. Because I think that's a lot of this work is hard too in articulating. I find anyway. I notice that's a challenge with me because it's very deep what we're talking about. And, you know, when we talk about creating change from within, it's a very, it's a complex process. So, so I just admire your ability to be able to articulate it so well.
Well, thank you, Michelle. And, you know, I mean, you're speaking to something so powerful because this work in so many ways is beyond words, right? And we attempt to use words to describe in some way the indescribable, or we try to use words, and words are limited. So we do the best we can. And I appreciate your recognition that what we're talking about here is really deep and transformational inner work. And we could call it inner clearing or opening up to the possibility that we are essentially whole and perfect, and that this is about dismantling in some sort of environment that is safe for us to do so. And so I want to honor you working as a coach and providing a space for people to go on this inner exploration. And I feel like that's exactly what's happening right now in consciousness in this paradigm in the 21st century, that we're all, so many of us are now on this exploration to our own wholeness. So thank you for recognizing that and for being that in the world yourself.
Thank you. And, you know, really resonated with me also with something you said pretty early on about we get to this point where it's, and I can't remember exactly how you worded it, but basically you're speaking to, we got to this point where we recognize that we have to change, that we can't keep going on in life the way we're going and expect our life to be any different. And that's what made me so passionate about this work, was that's what brought me to this path. I mean, I always really considered myself a spiritual or spiritual minded person, but I was, you know, as a young adult or teenager, I was not on any kind of spiritual kind of focused path. But it was when I got into my 20s and I went through some traumas in life, and I was, you know, all the dark stuff and the difficult stuff came up, realizing I just couldn't go forward that way. And so the focus for me originally was to just feel better, you know, feel better about life and not be so heavy and not deal with depression and anxiety and those kind of things. And it all on its own, it took this spiritual, it turned into this spiritual path. And now I recognize that, you know, our whole life is really a spiritual journey because we're spiritual beings having a human experience. But being able to work through those layers and peel back those layers that express in that way of those uncomfortable emotions of anxiety and depression and fears, being able to, you know, just pull them back one by one, you really do get to, that's how you get to your true self and enable that to shine through.
Absolutely, and you're speaking so beautifully to the experience that so many of us have, that pain can be a great motivator for us, right? Because if everything's going along really comfortably for whatever reason, you know, we don't really have any desire for maybe a deeper experience of life. So paradoxically, you know, pain or trauma can actually be a gateway or a doorway into a new way of being. It's certainly, and I want to be careful the way I say that, because I do hear people say things like cancer was a great gift. And I'm not saying that, because I think that, you know, the Native Americans say something so beautiful, and this is a paraphrase, I've read it, that nature is neither for nor against, right? So it's actually much more neutral than our minds may want to make it. But what I do know is that we can make we can choose to have any situation be useful to us. So in that way, a traumatic experience can be an opportunity for us to walk through a doorway and dismantle some of the ways we've been in the world. And for whatever reason, whether that's addiction, whether that's divorce, whether that's a disease of some sort, that often is such a fundamental turning point for people in their lives. And we hear it time and time again that that can be a great turning point. And it does seem that when each of us have that individual experience of transformation, those of us who have had that, who have had dark experiences and have been able to walk through that and have a profound awakening of sorts, that it does seem to be our calling to assist others with that in the world. And I hear that in your life, Michelle. And, you know, thank you for saying yes to your calling, because this is that's wanted and needed right now in the world. You know, we're looking at the events of the world right now that happened in Paris and around the world, and each of us are called now to really have a profound look at how we're going to respond. And so thank you for saying yes to your work.
Thank you. Thank you for acknowledging that. And, you know, I'd love to hear your feedback on this. One of the things when we talk about core beliefs, I don't know if it would really fall into a core belief. I haven't given it that much thought to it, but one of the things that I've noticed with people, and I noticed it was something I had to face within myself also, is a sort of an addiction to suffering. So I really appreciated, you know, your clarification about, you know, that statement of cancer being a gift, and it's not about, you know, that we want to have negative experiences in our life, but it's understand that if we do have them, there's an opportunity for us to respond in a way that's going to allow growth for ourselves. But I mean, is that something that you've come across in your work, that there seems to be? Yeah, that's the best way I can really kind of describe it. It's almost like an addiction, you know, very subconscious, on a very subconscious, very shadow kind of level, to suffering.
Absolutely. And, you know, absolutely. And I think, Michelle, one important distinction is to recognize what the difference between pain and suffering is. You know, pain is something that is a part of life. You know, we do have these bodies. We do have physical pain. We do have minds. We do have mental anguish and mental pain. Suffering is something that's quite different. Suffering actually lives in a belief. You know, I'm going to go back to what we were saying before the break, that suffering is the desire or the belief that something needs to be different than what it is right now. And one of the people that I respect so much is the work of Byron Katie, where he talks about loving what is, you know, and suffering comes from a desire, a deep desire to not be experiencing this moment. So yes, I think people are highly addicted to that, highly addicted. And that's something that we're trained, you know, we have religions that are built on a belief that we're supposed to suffer. And I think that is absolutely a great disease that's happening in human consciousness, that this idea that somehow we're supposed to suffer. So thank you for pointing that out.
Yeah, you know, as soon as you said it, like, I knew before you said her name, that's, you're going to say Byron Katie, because yeah, she totally addresses that whole, you know, my husband should be blah, 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 blah. My wife should be blah, 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 blah. And it's that recognizing that, well, if it should be, then it would be.
Right.
And that's such a challenge.
Yeah, and pain actually, you know, if we look at physical pain, you know, if we put our finger into into a fire, it's going to hurt. And that pain is wanting to tell us something. And that is, take your hand out of the fire, right? So pain is actually a really natural part of the human experience. And it's telling us something. Suffering is something completely different. And it's exactly as you said, anytime I'm using the word should, I know for sure that I am concretizing my own suffering, because if it should be something, it would be something. So it's really about, it's a really very interesting balance of accepting life as it is, and then also recognizing that we also don't have to stay there, that we do have the ability to change the experience of what we call reality based on how we perceive it. So I think a lot of people, when we start saying, you know, accepting things as they are, they move into a place of like, are we supposed to not take any action? And I know that's not what you're saying. So I love this conversation about suffering being an addiction, and certainly can be a core false belief. It could be a core false belief that I'm here to suffer, or that suffering's a part of life.
Yeah. And it really does. It goes back, you know, through the centuries, you know, back to, you know, not to get into the religious aspects of it, but I mean, it's all really there. I try to replace, when I catch myself with the word should, I try to challenge myself, well, what if I put could there? Because I think sometimes it's also a bit of intuition, you know, because when you're connected to your intuition, you also start to get that innate knowing that the situation could be different.
Absolutely.
And right, so sometimes that should is really coming in because you know that this situation could be better, and there's something that you could be doing to get it to that point of that greater experience for yourself and whoever else may be involved. So that's something that I try to challenge myself with, is, you know, if I want to say that should, say, well, this could be better, and then that can open up, you know, the other questions of, well, you know, how can I show up here, or what is needed from me for it to be that better?
Yes, that's so beautiful, because what you're moving in that conversation, we're moving from, you know, a victim consciousness or a stance of like, you know, this should be like something outside of me needs to change, and you're taking that into a place of empowerment, which is, I could do something different. And I love where you took it, because the next step then is to begin to question what it is that is wanted or needed in order for us to get to that place. And in my book, Conscious Being, I write about six words. I've chosen six words currently that I'm intending to completely eradicate from my language and from the words I use. And those are good and bad, right and wrong, should and must. And so I invite myself, when I hear myself saying those words, to ask, what is a different word that I can use that actually opens me up, to expands me into a greater consciousness, and moves me out of being a victim into a place of empowerment? And so I think what you're saying is incredibly powerful, and I'm sure that's the work you do with assisting your clients as well, to recognizing that. Because of course, you know, I had a great teacher that said, you know, there's three steps. The first step is awareness, the second step is awareness, and the third step is awareness. So you know, we first must recognize, and you hear I just said must, we could recognize that if we want to change, that we're going to have to become aware of the words that we use and how they limit us.
And, you know, limit, you know, that's just a thing that's really been coming up for me a lot lately, and just realizing what all this really does on this, also, you know, amongst everything else, but what it does to us in a spiritual sense is it limits our creativity, and our creativity is so much a part of our true essence. And when we can really start challenging ourselves to try different words, insert different words, insert different perspectives, we're really tuning into and building that creative muscle. And, you know, because creativity is not just about painting and writing beautiful music. You know, there's just so many different ways to be creative. And that's a big thing that I think is really lacking when you get, not just in our personal lives, but when you get into the global problems. It's that lack of creativity And that's what I think we need, more creativity to be able to solve these greater problems.
Yeah, and for some reason, what's occurring to me is a title of David Hawkins' book, Power Versus Force. I think about, you know, we've lived in a world that has so been dominated by force, and we're seeing that right now in the events that are being played out in the, you know, the larger scale with terrorism and how we respond or react to terrorism. And, you know, there's a lot of force, and that force, you know, prevents us from being the creative beings that we are. Power is something very different. When I recognized that I was living my life with a great deal of force, I mean, it really is what I was taught, right? We make things happen. We combat situations. We use our intellect, and, you know, it all felt very aggressive. When I shifted that into recognizing that this is about stepping into true power, power where there's a strong connection or a knowing of my intuitive sense, my intuitive nature. And as you so beautifully said, Michelle, that really is our essential nature, that we are these incredibly intuitive and creative beings, that when we all step into our own power, we don't need to use force. And that really is the way that we bring about peace in our personal lives and then globally as well.
So true, and it's so much to really think about there. And I think I really feel that that's the way that we need to really go.
Yeah, it seems like there's so many of us now on the planet doing this, and what we know is consciousness, you know, the collective consciousness does get elevated as each of us make a commitment to do our own inner work, and I know that's what's happening on the planet now, and it may take some time before it shows up in the manifest realm, but, you know, I know that that's happening, and I know, as, you know, the 100th monkey, when we reach that point of critical mass, peace will happen on this planet. I absolutely know that.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I do really feel that we are we're well into that.
Yeah.
Not to get off topic, but just really quick, it just popped into my head. There's so many people that they may not necessarily consider. What I find interesting, because when we talk about the manifestations of this, there's so many people that are out there that are doing. Using their creative minds and really, really doing work to create change on large scales, community scales, national scales. And they may not necessarily really even consider themselves spiritual, but they're doing such spiritual kind of service work in that way with that creativity. To me, that's really the expression of the mass consciousness, that how it is shifting, that people don't, there's a lot of people right now that are making a difference in the world that would not, you know, necessarily be considered part of, you know, a spiritual community, but the spirituality is there coming through that spiritual service work. And
yeah.
So to me, that's really showing proof that there's a lot happening. You know,
absolutely.
In a good sense.
That's a great example of how words are limited, right? Because spiritual means something different to everyone. And I hear you. There are so many people that to me and my framework and the way I would say it are such beautiful spiritual beings. They may not. Well, of course we know we're all spiritual beings, but they're on a conscious spiritual path and they may not use that word. An example of that is, you know, someone that's close to me that should remain nameless calls themselves an atheist, and here I am, you know, a spiritual author and have a spiritual community, and yet our spiritual beliefs are almost identical. It's just that we call it something very different. So that's such a great example of how words can be limiting. And one of the things I want to say too is I recognize that each of us are called to take action in different ways. For some of us, it really is a shift in internal consciousness that brings about change on the planet. For others, we are called to do work in the external realm. The important thing is that each of us now recognize what is ours to do, and that we make a commitment to clearing whatever it is that needs to be cleared, so that each of us can step more fully into our divine nature or our spiritual or essential self.
Yeah, I was working on a blog today, and what was coming up with for me was the unity through our diversity. You know, and that's really what, you know, I think that goes a lot along, you know, parallel with the creativity is, you know, understanding just how diverse we all really are. But at the same time, through that diversity, we have our unity. And I think the unity is about more about the intention, about that, what we're all working for. But that there's just such great diversity. Right? How many people are on the planet? 8 billion? You know, that's how many different paths there are. You know, that's how many different ways it can all show up. But, you know, deep down, you know, we come from the same place and we're all returning to the same place.
Absolutely. And, you know, essentially we're all one, and yet we're all these different, perfect, you know, unique expressions of the one source energy. So we may... from an external viewpoint, of course, we look and feel different, but essentially we know we're all the same. And that really is, anytime we speak about spirituality or these concepts, it's always in paradox. So we recognize that we're both unique and we're also one, and that those do live simultaneously. I'm reminded of the Rumi quote, and it's one of my favorites. I say it a lot, and that is that we're not a drop in the ocean, but we're the entire ocean in a drop. Those drops may appear different, but the entire ocean, the entire experience of humanity and a spiritual being all lives within each of us.
And so, that's where it stopped. I've gone off. Are you still with us? No, I've lost
the point.
Oh, wait, here we are.
You're really distorted.
Distortion. Welcome back to... Hey, you guys missed... You got to see if you can get to see Doctor Who. It's exactly about my the subjects of my show last night. The Doctor Who that was on at the weekend. It's insane. All about digital viruses. Digital mind viruses. Anyway, back to the show. TJ, do we have you back?
I'm here.
You're there, right. Michelle, are you still here?
I'm here.
We are all here. I am he. So, it's been good to hear you kind of, what's the word? Jam with each other there, because you both know what you're talking about, which is always good to have two people who know what they're talking about. In all of our approaches, I think we're looking at, and I think, you know, we haven't really spoken about it yet, but let's bring it out because it's the elephant in the room, is the inner child. So do you want to talk a little bit about your approach to inner child?
Yes, I would love to talk about that. That really is the essential, that is the at the core of the work that I do with people, certainly with the addiction work, but really in my awakening coaching practice as well, is helping people recognize that there is this child that is living within us that for most of us didn't get the love and attention and presence that we needed. And that's where those core false beliefs originated, right? We come into this world and we are looking for healthy attachment. We're looking for connection with our primary caregivers. For most of us, we didn't get that in the way that we might need spiritually. And of course, in different, you know, there's a spectrum of that experience, but for most of us, we didn't get the presence and the connection and that, that authentic, connection with our caregivers. So there is a separation from ourselves. And then that's where we develop, this ego or this false sense of ourself or these core false beliefs. So working with the inner child work, that really is recognizing that there's still that child within us that's yearning for that love, that connection, and that presence. And now we get to reparent ourselves. There was a book in the 80s that really changed my life, and it was called Reparenting. Now, I haven't read it in all those years, so I don't know actually what's contained within it at this point, but it was the first time that there was a concept for me, or the first time I was exposed to this concept that there is this child within me yearning for this connection, and that now I get to reparent myself. And what I didn't recognize is that I was talking to myself in the same ways that some of the people in my life were talking to me. It just became an internal experience. And so what a child needs to hear is that it's okay for you to be this way. It's okay in this moment. It's okay for you to feel this. It's okay for you to experience this. It's safe here and I love you. So that's the way that we get to reparent ourselves and do this, what we call inner child work. And that's to recognize that there is that part of ourselves that lives within us that is really yearning for this connection.
You know, a lot of times people see disease as something to be fought. And I've, in the last few years, began to think that disease is a conversation. Something is telling you something. That, and it, from what I can see, it's like the kids, he's trying to stick his toys in the driver's well, jam his toys under the pedals, just so they would listen.
Right.
You know, the inner child does desperate things to get you to listen to things, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And thank you for saying that about disease. You know, it is striking to me in the last few years, I've noticed in a really profound way, we hear things like, she lost her battle with cancer. And I'm always curious about what that means, you know, yes, that we're battling this, you know, we're battling it and that we lost. And, you know, as far as I can tell, we're all going to die. Now, I don't know if that's true, but it seems to be true. I'm open to the possibility that that could change. But at this point, that seems to be where we're all headed. So I'm wondering what it is about us fighting things, and thank you for drawing that metaphor or that parallel with the inner child. There is that, you know, it is like we talked about pain being useful because it's telling us something. Suffering is wanting our experience to be other than what it is. In that same way, when we have the commitment and the ability and the willingness to really listen to what that inner child is wanting and needing, there is so much information there. And when we're willing to actually open up and listen, we do get to experience a profound new way of being with ourselves, a much more integrated, more loving relationship with ourselves and with our thoughts, with our feelings, and with our entire experience of our being.
Michelle, your thoughts?
Yeah, I didn't tell that. Because you're so good at articulating, TJ.
Thank you.
About talking a little bit about kind of the joys of the inner child work. I think there's a stigma still with inner child work that it's this kind of heavy, kind of depressing kind of going into our dysfunction, but kind of place. But you know, there's for each aspect of the inner child, there's a brilliant spark, and I thought maybe you could kind of talk to that part of it also.
Well, yeah, how beautiful is that? Because it's true that a lot of times we get into these concepts and ideas and these practices, because they really are a practice, and it's easy for us to look at the darker or the more painful aspects. There's also a great joy in learning how to listen to and be with our inner child. And I want to speak to one aspect of this. Certainly when people come into this and we start talking about this inner child like it's a separate entity, that can feel really foreign to some people. And for me, it was very awkward at first because it felt a little, quite frankly, it felt a little schizophrenic, like we're all these different beings living inside of me. But it really is the framework that has helped me dramatically to recognize like my thoughts, my ego, exists, but it's not the truth of who I am. And one of the ways I frame this is Our essential self, our spiritual self, actually can be the witness to all of this. So I recognize that there's this child self living within me that really is yearning for love and connection. And when I can witness that, it does feel like I'm talking to or working with or being with a separate entity. And Michelle, I love that you talked about the joyful aspect of it too, because when I recognize that I actually can provide the love and connection for that part of me that we might call shadow, that's repressed, that's in the unconscious, that's where we get this experience of what we call bliss. It's like, wow, you know, in my own life, it took me 40 years in my life before I recognized that that's what all of this kind of bizarre behavior was me seeking love. And one of, you know, I love the Course in Miracles, you know, and it says everything is love or fear, but I actually reframe that now to say that everything is love or a request for love. So that inner child, that part of ourselves that is in the, you know, we could call it the repressed self, the shadow, the unconscious self, is yearning for love and connection and attention. And that moment that I recognized I could provide that for myself rather than seeking outward was a moment that I had these intense spiritual experiences, because I got to experience bliss. I got to experience oneness within myself. Because we talk a lot about oneness being, you know, recognizing we're in unity and one with all other beings. But the moment that I integrated those parts of myself that I called human and spiritual, that was where the deepest and most profound experiences of bliss occurred, because it was as if finally something was able to recognize that all of this stuff happening from within me was really a desire for love and connection. When I was able to provide that for myself, I had this incredible experience of bliss and oneness and connection.
That really kind of speaks to, you know, what we were saying earlier about the global oneness, and that there's diversity within all of us as individuals from each other. We're united by this one common desire, you know, and place that we come from and place that we're going to. But then that also, it's almost like the kind of like the microcosm, you know, that also exists within ourselves, that there's so many different aspects of self. We really are very complex, very intricate beings, and there's so many different aspects of self, but they're all really joined together at the core, our true essential, our true essence, joins with this love in a divine sense.
Yeah, and this may sound unrelated, but I promise you I'm gonna bring it back to what you're saying, Michelle. There's a great story. Ellen Burstyn was studying for a role, and she committed to going one full day in Beverly Hills dressed as a homeless person, and she would only eat what people gave her. And that was how she was going to study for this role. And she was, you know, she was dressed very disheveled and, you know, dressed as a homeless person, and walked up to these two women at an outdoor table in Beverly Hills and asked them for money. And one of the women reached into her bag and pulled out a $20 bill and handed it to Ellen, but never looked at her. And she said that was a very profound moment in her life, because she recognized that what people are wanting is to be seen. It's not the money that she wanted. It was that human connection. And so if we look at that as an outpicturing of what's happening internally, we reject those parts of ourselves in the same way we reject homeless people, as an example, or we reject someone that's from a different political party or someone from a different religion. So what's happening externally is exactly what's happening internally. And what I recognize is that when we do the internal work of this kind of this union, this acceptance, this compassion and love for all parts of myself, I can do that externally. When I can do that externally, I can do that more for myself. So it's not one or the other. It's a combination of doing both of those and recognizing that it's actually the same exact process. It happens externally and internally. I mean, one of the things in the external realm that shifted for me dramatically when I heard Ellen Burstyn telling that story is, you know, in San Francisco, I have plenty of opportunities to encounter homeless people on a daily basis. I made a commitment to start looking deeply into the eyes of every homeless person, and it radically changed the way I related to myself and to the world. It's been a really profound experience for myself. And then I recognized that that's exactly what's happening internally. The more I'm willing to look, to actually look at those parts of myself that I might want to reject, the more I can experience this integration and this bliss.
That's what I call healing the inner Nazi.
Absolutely. That's absolutely right.
So
we could frame that as healing the internal terrorist at this point.
Yes, you could say that. You could say that. So, because, you know, it's just as false. Boom. Anyhow, so we have a question. This is from it was way back because it was in the first hour. It was Finnegan. Hang on. that was quite fun during SDM show. A little bit of a crosstalk there. We managed to get on the air without the it slipped through. Anyway, that was quite fun. Here we go. I'm just trying to find this piece here, which all the way down. There we go. Here we come. Okay, so now here we go from Finnegan. Bright light scissors, birth certified, crying / birth is a huge trauma. Regression back into the oceanic bliss. The question is, do you think psychedelics can have a meaningful impact on addiction? I mean, I'm presuming he's meaning one of these psychedelics that, you know, not as addictive like ayahuasca, because you wouldn't want to take that too many times a week. It's like...
Yeah, it's interesting that that question is being asked. One of the controversial things that not a lot of people may know is Bill Wilson, who's one of the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous, actually experimented with psychedelics in his sobriety as a way to have an intense spiritual experience. So even though you might say a common wisdom within recovery circles would be that would not be a tool, paradoxically or ironically, the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous actually explored that at one point. My answer for that is I think that there are many things that can be a tool for our awakening. When we use drugs, psychedelics to have an intense spiritual experience, I would say that can be an authentic experience. The issue becomes when we believe that we may crave more of that experience. And it's on some level, and I want to be careful how I say this, on some level, it's not the most authentic experience of an awakening. It's still chemically induced. So it can produce great results for people. I know that, you know, different kind of psychedelics have been used in a lot of religious and spiritual circles. I don't really honestly have an opinion. It's not something that I've experimented with personally. It's not something I've certainly not done that with any work with any clients. But I have heard of people that have done that and that they've had great experiences. For me, the way I would frame it, or the question I would ask, is there a more organic or authentic way to experience this without needing to use something outside of ourselves to have this experience? And for me, the answer is yes. I think there's a more holistic approach to reaching that experience.
Okay, thank you. And so in another, you know, this is another outer experience versus inner experience. And this is, can there be a paranormal effect on addiction? For instance, say there's a curse on your family line. How does one block the outside sorcerers from getting you addicted? Now, I'm guessing what the answer to your question is, but it's not... You're the guest, so please. Go ahead.
Well, I would actually love to hear what you think the guest would be, because I think that would be really fun.
Well, I mean, it's basically, you know, if you're seeing something as an outside sorcerer and you're seeing something as a curse, how is that curse coming into effect by your believing that it's that such a thing can A, exist, and B, have an effect on you?
Right, absolutely.
There has to be a hook in you that believes that curses can be real.
Yes, exactly. Like, what would it be for, like, I remember at one point really early in my evolution, recognizing that, that this is true. You know, it was a very new concept for me. Wow, it's not actually what's happening. It's my belief about what's happening that's creating my reality. And I remember I broke a mirror and I said, oh, 7 years of good luck now. You know, it really is what we frame it. You know, someone might say 7 years of bad luck for breaking a mirror. And when we believe that's true, absolutely, that will have that effect. So this is definitely an inside job. And of course, there are outer influences. I'm not saying that there aren't. There's collective consciousness, and there are powers in our external realm. But what happens internally is so much more powerful than anything that can happen outside of ourselves.
Michelle.
I'm just thinking of what he said earlier. You know, TJ, when we were talking, well, you guys, I wasn't on you. You guys were talking about the triggers and you used the word activation. I love that. And I have always used the word trigger, and I think I'm switching over to activation because it's, I think that's a great question to ask yourself is what is this experience? What is this influence, this external influence? What is it activating within me? Because I think that's the real big misunderstanding is that, yes, there are external influences. There are, right? There are these other consciousnesses. But without having something to be able to be activated, that's the beauty and that's the power of being human, is that if you don't hold it, it can't be activated within you.
Right, absolutely. And that is something that, to me, that's what positive, whether we call it spiritual or not, community, how that can serve us. Because doing this on our own can be a concept and can be, and possibly can be very challenging. But when we come together with people holding that intention, like, you know, even in this conversation, that when the three of us are coming together with the intention of exploring this, we have the ability to work with that, to practice that, because that's why we call it a spiritual practice, right? We continue to play with these ideas and these ways of being and these practices until that we can do it and become stronger in those. That's really the purpose of spiritual community. So we can hold each other to our highest and best in really working with this in a very profound way.
Well, I'd like to say thank you very much. We're coming to the end of the show. We've got about 5 minutes left, but let's you know, just kind of bring it down to a nice soft landing, because you know it's been really worth it. Thank you very much, TJ, for coming along, and thank you for getting in touch with me. You know, it's probably just part of the routine of speaking, but I hope it's been useful for you today.
Oh, it's been really wonderful. I love being in this conversation. There's always new insights that come with collective consciousness and sharing in consciousness and coming together and exploring and looking at ways we can experience this all in a different way, because it's one thing to have concepts and ideas, but it's another thing to really integrate those into ways of being. So, yes, it's been incredibly useful for me.
Well, thank you.
TJ, is your book published already, or it's in the works?
Thank you. The book is published. It's called Conscious Being. You can get it, of course, on Amazon. The best way to reach me is tjwoodward.com, and there's also a link there to our spiritual community in San Francisco and also a way to buy the book.
Awesome. So, tjwoodward.com. There's nothing difficult about that. It's funny because Michelle has a show on my radio station called Conscious Living.
Oh, wow.
And your book's called Conscious Being. It's like having, you know, it's like there's a reflection across the Turtle Island there. So it's been very interesting to have you. I'd love to have this in stereo. That would be really cool if I could have it. Just have you sort of one to the left, one to the right. But this has been Journeys with JP. A couple of announcements, by the way. My site, everbeyondradio.com, was taken down yesterday. Was it yesterday? I don't know. Sometime. it was working all right, and then, you know, all my MySQL server's been knocked out. So if anybody can help me reset the password on my MySQL server and walk me through that and take me through the panic of fixing this thing, I'd be very happy to speak to someone. My guest, TJ Woodward, has published a book, Conscious Living, which is a conscious being. Conscious being.
My spiritual community is called Awakened Living, so it's a hybrid.
Ah, oh, wow. There we go. So if you'd like to buy that, how do you do that? Do you go to Amazon?
The best way to get it is on Amazon, yes. And again, you can find a link on my site, tjwoodward.com, as well.
There you go. Might as well put a plug in there, Michelle.
Well, my website is infinitylifedesigns.com, and Conscious Living is actually this Sunday. I'm going to have Dolly on with me. Dolly Howard will be on with me Sunday, 2 o'clock New York time. And not to put you on the spot, TJ, but I would really love to have you as a guest on my show in the near future.
I would be delighted to be a guest on your show. Yes, please send me an email. I would love that.
I will. I will definitely connect with you.
Great.
Such a pleasure. Thank you both for allowing me to share this space with you guys. Real treat.
It's been a delight.
Beautiful timing. Thank you, Will. It's been a lovely soft landing. Good night, everybody. This was Journeys with JP.